I realized in thinking about this talk tonight, which I'm just starting to get a name for, which I thought the name of it could be The Limitations of Language. But in thinking about it, I now realize that a more appropriate name for the talk might be What Am I Talking About? Because I'm not quite sure yet. And that's why I wanted to call it What Am I Talking About, so that when you have that same question come up in your mind as I'm starting to talk, you'll know that was the topic of the talk. So, well, this idea for this talk came this morning over breakfast when I had a wonderful conversation with people. We were eating breakfast and we started to talk about language and talk about some of the things we had been talking about last night in the larger group. And somehow a series of words were exchanged and I think I left the room and some of the people left the room feeling like something really profound had been said. And I said to Christopher, well, I think I'd like to give a talk tonight. And now I can't remember what actually had been said. And so I'm just starting to think of it again. And I think what I'd like to talk about is there's something I've been thinking about in my life for a couple of years that has to do with how language can be a kind of hypnotic spell or a wonderful magic conjuring act, can be a prison house, or it can be a road to heaven. And you might have experienced during the retreat ways in which your thoughts or what you were saying to yourself or saying to someone else, depending on how you were saying it, could be a prison or a box, as in self-judging thoughts, or could be a gateway to heaven, as in what an amazing sunset. Some of the ways in which words can lock us up or set us free. And actually, the thing I wanted to focus on in terms of words and language, it's just the way in which, when I sometimes use a word, this is the magic spell I'm thinking of, and when I use a word, or when I use words to label or describe something, to represent something, for example, this shawl, it seems as if, by giving it a name, this shawl now is an independent, separate thing. And it kind of has an existence all of its own. I think with that one label, just giving it that one label, I have put myself under a kind of magic spell. Because I will now think of this shawl as being completely separate from everything else. I can very easily do that. It's only when I stop and ask myself, what exactly is a shawl, that I start to realize, unless I start talking about something else, like it goes around my shoulders, or it keeps me warm, or so on, I will have no idea what it is. And I think the sense that naming something it does not necessarily have a lot of meaning until I start to talk about what that thing is that I named, how it is related to everything else. Now that seems simple enough, I think. To me it seems simple enough because it's obvious right away when I say shawl. Everybody automatically knows what a shawl is and what you use it for and so on. It seems to be a kind of implied agreement. We all understand what a shawl is, how it's used, what it's related to. So I don't think there's much of a problem in using a name in that way. But I think where it starts to get trickier is in when I start to talk about my mind, or when I start to talk about my feelings, or when I start to talk about what wisdom is, or when I start to talk about what enlightenment is, or when I start to talk about what love is. Things that are not necessarily where what the thing is or what I can point to is not necessarily so apparent. And yet, in giving a label to love or to wisdom or to anger or any of those things, in giving it a name, it seems as if those things, now that I've talked about them, they're things, are somehow separate, real, distinct things. That they have a life of their own, that I can, as it were, go look for them in my experience to go find them. I could somehow, if I ask the question, what is wisdom? That's not such a good example for, trying to think of a more, has anyone gone to find wisdom here? In other words, that the word could lead me to go look for something. And maybe it may be obvious to people that what wisdom is and what love is not a thing, in the same way as to what a shawl is. And in fact, until I start to talk about or describe the way in which the words love or wisdom or enlightenment or anger or sadness and so on are related to, as Krista was saying yesterday, other situations, in fact, other words, those words just don't mean anything until I connect them to other words, until I use other words to describe and define what they are. And what those words are, none of the words mean anything by themselves. They always words need to be together, they need to be connected to mean something. They need to refer to each other, they're interdependent with each other. Now at this point you might be thinking, what is he talking about? Which is the basis for the lecture actually. That's the original name of the lecture. What is the implication of this? And really it's very simple. I think what I prompted this was that we started talking about in the lecture all kinds of things, like intuition and what is thought and so on, as if somehow, or what is my experience like, here's the best one of all, what is my experience like apart from concepts? Now this is a very interesting concept. And it's an interesting way to talk. I guess I hear this type of understand this way of putting it very often at retreats. I'd like to get to my bare experience free from concepts. And it's a remarkable concept, because what it does in that moment of saying that is it starts you looking for something that has nothing to do with how you're talking, supposedly. But somehow you're going to recognize it. Somehow you're going to be able to find this thing. It sets you up looking for something. And I think that's the spell of language, is thinking you can go after saying something like, I'm going to now look for or find something in my experience that's free from concepts, and then having found it, now I'm going to describe it to you. And it seems like the way I'm describing it, the language that I'm using, is just a pale reflection of that experience. It's, as it were, just representing it, describing it, but the experience somehow was there. Totally apart from the language that I'm using. And I guess my question is, is this possible? Can I talk about my experiences using language, and in fact, having learned long ago what the word experience means, and having learned long ago what the word non-conceptual experience means by talking about it with people, is it then possible to go find non-conceptual experiences that have nothing to do with words? This gets back to the topic again of what am I talking about? Is that possible, in other words? Is it possible? And what kind of goose chase will that become? And how many times have you thought that you found something in your experience, or looked for something in your experience, as if, and treated it as if it had nothing to do with the way you were using language to describe it, and become mesmerized by your experience and your language that you use to describe it, as if the language was just completely apart from this experience? I keep coming back and looking for my experience, and then I describe it to you, and I pretend that the way I'm talking, the way I'm describing it, has nothing to do with the experience. I think, anyway, this is the great magic act. Because what it does is it keeps me thinking that what I say about experience doesn't also invent the experience, make it be whatever it is in that moment. If I can't talk to you about my experiences apart from the language that I use to describe them. I mean, if I can't, in a sense, talk about non-conceptual and non-verbal experiences except through words, I think that says something about the limits of language, which is, if there's something that's beyond language, how am I going to talk about it? If meditation takes me to a place that may have nothing to do with words and language, whatever that place is, again, here I'm setting it up in the way I talk, how am I going to talk about this? And that's actually a question I don't know. I have no idea how you could do that. I think that realizing that no matter what I say will still just be how I talk, it might change my relationship to language and to experience, this idea of experience. I might realize that what I have to say about all my experiences may not accurately represent something else, but it may just be the way that I'm talking about my experiences. And what I have to say is just how I'm talking. Now, this to me actually was very profound at one point, because I realized that I had been going around thinking that I was accurately describing my experiences in the world and so on. I was just trying to accurately describe what was there. I really thought there was something that I was accurately describing. When I started to realize that what I was describing was simply the way I was describing things, was just the way I was talking. I was talking about the way I was talking, and I was talking further about the way I was talking, and I was talking further about the way I was talking. I kind of got the sense that I wouldn't actually be able to accurately describe anything other than the way I was talking about what I was talking about what I was talking about what I was talking about. And I kind of felt like I was lost in a circle of talking about what I was trying to talk about, trying to thought. To that point that I started to realize there was a certain limitation here to what I could talk about. And that limit sense of the limitation threw me into a sense of what I'm now going to use another word, mystery, or bewilderment, or doubt, about somehow being able to sum up or describe the way the world or the universe really is. And starting to get a bizarre sense, coming up against the sense of talking about what I was talking about, that I guess the words that I would use, and here again, I'm unfortunately going to use more words, is something that went to me like, I don't know what's going on, in a certain sense. Certain sense of just not knowing. When I'd sit down to meditate, I'd think, I'm having these sensations, and then I think, sensations? I see. That's what I must be having, huh? Or then I'd say, how's this feeling here? I realize, I see there's a feeling there, right? Or I'd have a thought come through and I'd think, I see that's thinking. And then I hear another thought say, oh yeah, what's thinking now? What is it? Could you explain to me what a thought is? And again, that sense of the mystery. And actually, right now, a little voice is coming up and saying, could you explain to me what mystery is? So I'm just saying, I guess, and this is, I don't know how clearly I'm saying it, probably, as I said, I'm reminded of, I don't know what I'm talking about. I actually like the name of the talk. That probably would have been just enough just to say that. Of a poem. I kind of felt very awkward coming down to talk about this because I realized the tremendous difficulty of talking about what I'm trying to talk about that actually is I don't know what I'm talking about. So on. There's a sense in which, though, I'm just trying to say that past a certain point, I don't think language can explain anything other than what it's already trying to explain, and explaining more language about more language about more language. And maybe all these things that it seems like language is accurately describing are just more explanations about how I want to use this word, and how I want to use this word, and how I want to use this word, which is just a way in which we all talk to each other and agree that we're now using words in a way that makes sense. So, in other words, language is a kind of agreement that we have about how things are. And that's it. For me. Of course, that's just one way of talking about it. I hope you don't now think that that explains anything. So, there is a wonderful poem by the Chinese philosopher Chuang Tzu that kind of said more elegantly than certainly I think I'm explaining it. This idea of the limits of language, the limitations of language. And I'll just read you a little of it. Cocks crow, dogs bark. This all men know. Even the wisest cannot tell whence these voices come or explain why dogs bark and cocks crow when they do. beyond the smallest of the small, there is no measure. Beyond the greatest of the great, there is also no measure. And measure here meaning language. Nothing to say. There's nothing to say. When there is no measure, that is when there's nothing to say, there's no distinction to make, there is no thing. In this void, you can speak of causes, or you can speak of chances. You can speak of things where there are no things. That is, I can say that something is there, my mind, my emotions, etc., etc. I can say that something is really there. On the other hand, what's there is just the way I'm talking. That thing, just the way I'm talking. And then he says, to name a name is to make a thing. When I look beyond the beginning, I find no measures. When I look beyond the end, I find also no measure. Where there is no measure, there is no beginning of anything. Anything. If you speak of cause or chance, causes of things, then you speak of the beginning of some thing. Then he says, well, just from that part, I like that summary of it. Then, taking that a little bit further, there's another thing he says that I think I like also explaining this. When we look at things in the light of Tao, and this time I'll just translate Tao very loosely to mean a kind of name of something. We look at things in terms of the light of naming things. How's that for a free translation of the word Tao? Actually, you know, it's very interesting. I was reading a book by Alan Watts where he talks about the first line of the Tao Te Ching, where it says, the Tao that can be said is not the real Tao, say, as some people say. Five translations of that single first line. One of them was, the Tao that can be spoken about is not the only way to speak about the Tao. The name I have given to something is not the only way that I could describe what that thing is. It says, when we look at things in the light of Tao, nothing is better, nothing is worse. Each thing, seen in its own light, stands out in its own way. It can seem to be better than what it is compared, than what is compared with it on its own terms. But, seen in terms of the whole, that's of talking about everything, no one thing stands out as better. If you measure differences, what is greater than something else is great. Therefore, there is nothing that is not great. And what is smaller than something else is small. So the whole cosmos is a grain of rice and the tip of a hair, or it's as big as a mountain. Such is the relative view. That when you make distinctions with language, you can talk about something as being bigger than something else, but you could just as easily talk about it as being smaller than another thing. It all depends on how you're talking about it. So this is just to disabuse, I guess, us of the sense that what a thing is has nothing to do with how we talk about it. So anyway, this is I didn't want to actually talk too long about this past certain point. So this is the conclusion of the talk. It's called "What Am I Talking About?" And I will just now throw open the floor here to any questions that you might have, and I will try to say more about whatever it is we're talking about, or not. So, if you have any questions.
You said that the language together, preaching, or the way to heaven. And the more I think about it, the more it seems that it's only a prison, actually.
It's only a prison in
well, because of what you were saying, that it's impossible to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's an interesting question. Is it possible to get out of language? And in this question, it's like making language into a thing that I now have to get out of. Right? But actually, what is this thing called language? Is the question, you know, what is it actually a thing? Is it like a thing that I'm inside of? And I think the way I was talking, I was kind of setting that up. So I've been talking about language as if it's a thing. But could anyone ever stop describing what language is in that sense? I'd be hard pressed to do so. So in that way, it's not necessarily something. It's not a thing. It's just talking about language that way, it's to isolate language and make it some kind of, as if it was the same thing as the shawl. Yeah.
I had a thought a few days ago about language, and I saw it as being like a painting of a scene or something. So it's merely a representation of what is. It isn't the thing of what is. It's just someone's interpretation, and therefore different people will put different interpretations. They'll paint differently, some perhaps more accurately than others. But when I look at it that way, because it's merely an interpretation, doesn't negate the existence of the thing that you're describing with the language.
So in this case, it seems like language is just a means of interpreting something, whatever it might be. I mean, what would be an example of that?
An experience, like something that we experience while meditating.
Some non-conceptual experience during meditation, which has nothing to do with language, right? Although it's just been called a non-conceptual.
What we can do, and an absence of thought.
So there's some kind of experience that I might have when I'm very still, that I then start to label as the absence of thought. And in calling it the absence of thought, I have now said something about that experience with language, characterized it, said when there's thought, there's this, when there's not thought, there's that. Right? I'm just staying with that example. You've already said something about it as soon as you say my legs are itching.
Yes, but if they weren't, I could just think about things and things and go on.
So there's something. Well, I want to actually just finish that one thing and come back to this. Just in calling that experience, there's the absence of thought. That is a very interesting thought about that experience. In other words, I'm saying there's this experience I have called absence of thought. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
That is making it into, that is drawing a mark on it, marking it off and saying, let me put it this way, how is it possible to recognize the absence of thought? Exactly. Right. So it's thought about, thought saying, there's no thoughts here. But that's a way of thinking about that experience. And that's a way of thinking. That's just a way of thinking. I don't know if that's any clearer, but I mean that in a sense then, I've used thought to say there's no thought here.
It's an attempt to describe sort of thing rather than as a process, isn't it?
Mm. You mean that using thought to describe this absence of thought?
Well, it isn't a thing, is it?
No, if it's not a thing, then what is it?
Well, I don't think that proves anything.
You mean proves anything in terms of, I don't know what I mean,
I mean, it doesn't deny the existence of this process.
Well, it's not to deny that something might be going on, but it's not to say, I know what that is, that whatever that something is.
I was thinking that perhaps nothing was going on.
But that would be another interesting thought about what was going on. I mean, you know, it would be, there's something that goes on and then there's nothing that goes on, and, you know, I see, so this one's nothing and that one's something. I mean, I think it's a koan. Tell me what a thing is without talking about it. Or without, you know, how could you, tell me what a thing is. Or tell me what no thing is. Tell me what nothing is. Tell me what the absence of something is. That's a koan. No answer. Just meditation.
And I would like to ask him what stillness is.
Well, how again, what is stillness? Hmm. Well, I could tell you that stillness is not moving. But what is that thing? In other words, to talk about stillness, I'd have to talk about a lot of other things. And I could. I mean, I could describe it, right? I could say, you know, stillness is... I could give you an example. This is still... This is moving. Now you all know what the word stillness means. Or one of the ways to talk about it. But does that say what stillness is? Ultimately, other than just saying, you know, giving a label to, you know, doing this and then doing this? I mean, does that explain it? I mean, does that really explain what that is? Or is that just saying, oh yeah, that's stillness, right?
I would like to know why prison is a prison. Because the meeting last night made me think, I imagine, what is if we are all computers? And I think a lot of people would refuse to be a computer.
Mm.
And I think it wouldn't change anything.
It wouldn't change anything if we were...
It wouldn't. If we would be a computer, it wouldn't change anything. Because there would be just the same thing as it is.
It would just be another name for the same thing, whatever that might be.
However, who's programming you, or if you are programming yourself, or whatever's going on. So this, and of course, the computer is some kind of prison. But within that prison, where is the prison?
Right. It's just another word, another description. Just the way waving this back and forth and saying it's still or it's moving is just a description about something that we couldn't probably finish explaining tonight or finish talking about. The difference is, I think, though, I think ultimately, in a sense, that may be the case. I mean, that whatever you call it, you still haven't ultimately explained what it is. Whether if you're calling a person a computer, or you're calling them a watermelon, or you're calling them an angel, or whatever. It's a way of speaking. But the ways that we have of speaking have different implications for how we act with each other in the world. The world of us acting together. So in a certain sense, it does make a difference what I call something, obviously. If I describe a person as...
How you call it.
How I call it. Yeah.
The way you call it.
The way I call it makes a difference.
Yeah.
I mean, if I think of myself as a computer, then I might start to think that we could call that a metaphor. That has implications for then how I think I should act. Right? I'll think, well, I have to act how I'm programmed. Of course, that's what computers do. I mean, there's no choice. Computers, they only do one thing. You put the program in, that's what they do. You put a garbage program in, you get garbage out. So if I'm a computer, I have to act according to my program. There's nothing I can do about that. Whatever programmed me, that's what's going to be happening. So you might say, be careful about what you're going to call yourself. Because you might have to act that way. If I called myself there's a very popular notion, I think, in Western psychology of thinking of ourselves as kind of what I'd say some kind of hydraulic plumbing system. That is, if I push something here, something will pop out over here. If I have a certain feeling here like this, if I push too hard on it, like something's going to pop out over there. So we talk, I mean, it's a metaphor, it's a way of talking that we, one of the ways of talking about ourselves that I think has been very popular, I mean, since Freud started it. So I think, then I might tend to think of my emotions as kind of like fluids inside me. And if an emotion gets too big, it might build up, and if I don't have any valves to let it out, I'll explode. I mean, I'll explode. It's a way of thinking about emotion. I mean, you know, people use it, talk that way. But it has implications. I could start to feel like I'm a pressure cooker. As indeed, I have on many times. And I had to go somewhere because I thought, I might explode and get all over people. And it'll be very messy and hard to clean up. And you know, who knows, it might be before, you know, we have to go eat or something. What a mess that would make. So, you know, again, it's a way of thinking about myself. Is it real? Is, you know, waving this and calling it motion real? Just a way of talking. That has implications for how I act, how I act with people. I've actually gotten back into this talk again.
You mentioned talking. This is just a concern about the use and the frequent use of this concept of energy.
Yes.
And the size of energy. That reminds me of the hydraulic pump.
Right. Energy. See, now this is not a popular word yet in Europe compared to the United States, especially compared to California, where everyone has got some kind of energy. I mean, it might be good energy, it might be bad energy, it might be shakti energy, it might be oatmeal energy, I don't know. Could be petrochemical energy. Energy, and I don't know if this is popular here, but I mean, I'm talking about it as it's used in the United States. I could start to think of myself as a person. I mean, I think this idea of how you think of yourself as a person is so important because, you know, you'll act in a lot of different ways depending on how you think of yourself as a person. So, I could think of myself as a person that is filled with energy. Right? Now, Einstein said energy is the same thing as matter. I mean, that's what his equation, that's what he was proving, basically, is that energy equals matter. I don't know if that, I hope you believe that, maybe you don't. Anyway, thinking of myself as energy, again, I get into a similar, this is a tough question, Christopher, to explain. I could start to think of myself as either filling up with energy, not having enough energy, which really makes sense in a certain sense because it's true, you know, I have to eat food and I need a certain amount of energy to metabolize and to walk around and to talk, and if I stop eating, and that's energy, I mean, that's energy in the sense of it's combustible. I use it. Energy also is talked about as a word as a measurement. I mean, basically the word energy comes out of physics, and the way it's defined is a British thermal unit, or a calorie, or the temperature outside of it. Not quite, it's a measure of the difference between the heat as it is now, and, you know, you burn more wood and the heat goes up a certain amount. And it goes up what? In what? It goes up on the thermometer, which is this little way we have little marks on it. We say, now the heat's going up, right? That's a measurement of energy. But if I start to think of energy as some kind of spiritual fluid circulating in my veins, kind of like now I have more energy, now I don't. I'm starting to think then of energy as some kind of substance. I'm starting to think once again of myself as some kind of thing that fills up with some kind of fluid, invisible fluid, or decreases in having this. But I'm starting to think of myself as a person with this thing going on inside me called having energy or not, or certainly. Now this, I don't know if this actually makes any sense in terms of the application, but energy then can start to become a very mysterious term. I can look at someone and say, that person has got good energy. I mean, that, you know, what does that mean? Have any of you ever, let me ask you this, has anyone ever said that? No, never? Yes? Yeah. And then you make, it's like any other thing in language, it's sort of what we're talking about in the group. You say, that person has got good energy, but some of it, or that person has got bad energy, I better not let any of it get on me. You know? And it's like you could almost walk up to the person and say, uh-oh, some of it's drooling over here. You know? And really believe it. You know? Really think, some of it's got on me. And, you know, what are you doing? I mean, you're setting up this person as being some kind of substance that's spilling out over onto your territory. And, you know, think about this. We're bound to have some conflicts. There's no way we can't. Because I don't want your energy getting near my energy. That's just the way it is. You know, you keep your energy over there, I keep my energy over here. I don't want it near mine. My energy is clean. I use unleaded. So, I mean, it's All I'm saying here is not to say the word, you know, don't ever say the word. Be careful what you think, what you believe about the word, because you might end up thinking all kinds of, might think of a person as a kind of thing. I mean, the language, I'm just saying the language can hypnotize us just like that. Just like that. Pretty soon I'm believing certain, I know this is not popular here in California, it is very popular. People have all kinds of energy, and you have to keep some people's energy fields out of yours because it gets on yours and that kind of complications result. Even you could think of emotions like that, it's not very far off. You know, some people have certain emotions and it gets on you. What's an alternative way to talk about it? Right? But maybe. I mean, that's a question I would have at this point. Right. There's something about the way that person acts. When they act that way, I make a certain assumption or I have certain values and I don't like that. It has to do with the values, with the way that I'm, the way that I like to define who I am, what I like, what I don't like. It has to do with the language that I'm using to define who and what I am. I mean, I don't know if that's what you mean. But. So an alternative way is just to describe using description, using, it's a different, it's being, you might say, being, reflecting on that, it's not that somebody actually is a thing, this pot of energy or this pool of energy that kind of comes out. The way somebody is has to do with the way I interpret how they are. It has to do with the thoughts that I use. And the way I think of myself often has to do with the thoughts, the language that I use to describe myself. I was talking about this whole idea of making things out of language, using language to make things. And this Hopi Indian, and it was a descendant from a Hopi Indian, had a really interesting story. He said that somebody had asked him, somebody who was a friend of his actually, who was still living with the tribe, who was older, much older, he wasn't kind of educated with Western education. Some American who was living nearby, how many sheep he had in his pasture. And this guy did not know what he meant. Because he was not used to, he did not think of there being these little things up there called sheep. That his sense of the sheep was much less measured. And he, the way this person was describing was, this guy kind of thought of it as sheeping in the pasture. It's a completely different way to look at it. It wasn't these discrete little bits that are all kind of, you know, there being against each other. It was just sort of like, there was more like this general activity of sheeping in this pasturing. That was the way the language kind of translated. But the question of how many sheep do you have just didn't make that much sense. Because the Hopi language has much more built into it a sense of motion. Most American Indian languages really don't talk as much about things as they talk about motion between. The focus is more on relationships between in the language, which our language focuses more on objects and not the relationship between. So we really tend to thingify a lot. Yeah. So he was also saying that this sense of, as you might have experienced just in meditating, you find how much one thing is related to another thing. And after a while, the things aren't there, it's just constant relationships. That the Hopi language is very much like that, and that when the white man started to come in and limit the reservations of the Indians, some of the younger Indians started to become educated in Western thinking and started to lose the Hopi language. What happens is a very high incidence of alcoholism among American Indians. because they just cannot cope with this Western worldview, which says, basically, they're just things. You're a thing, your land is a thing, etc., etc., etc. And these things barely have any relationship to each other. Whereas they're coming from a language that says, relationship, relationship, relationship. Looking, it's not a room of people, it's peopling. So what happens with the younger generation, when they lose touch with this, is they just suicidal, depressed, alcoholism. Okay. The elders who kept the language and the tradition were able to adapt to the changes without the depression, the alcoholism, etc. I mean, they could see that their things were being taken away from them, but they didn't have the same kind of, because they hadn't lost that worldview, that view of interrelationship. Anyway, that's the Hopi story. So.
And one thing that we were talking about in the group discussion was how it's quite common in retreats for people to think of themselves in terms of connected or disconnected, or present and not present. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
Feeling connected or disconnected, or present or not present. Right? Well, again, I think it's just a question of the language, you know. If I say that I am connected to you, I'm making certain assumptions. I'm doing it because, like, when I say I'm connected, I might look at you and say, gee, I notice everyone's looking at me. I'm looking at everyone else. I guess that means being connected. Or I might feel, it's kind of like I'm breathing easily. I don't feel like putting this up over here and hiding behind it. Or so I guess I'm connected. Now, if you all were suddenly to fall over and go to sleep, I might call that not being connected. But the important thing to notice is that whether I feel connected or whether I don't feel connected has to do with how I describe being connected or not being connected. It's a description of. And what is connection past that? It's based on a description. Now I am connected, I'm making these assumptions, now I'm not.
Do you think there could be some sense of experience of unsatisfaction? And you choose any one of a number of labels, one of which could mean disconnected, could be disconnected.
Mm-hmm. Could be. I have some sensation. That sensation seems, I don't like it, I don't want it, therefore I am unconnected. I mean, you just link the two up. I think being present and not being present is a real, another good one. How do you know you're being present? I mean, unfortunately, this was actually a discussion we had that I thought was very difficult to describe, but I sort of thought about it a little more. How do you know that you're being present? I mean, it's another great that people spend hours at retreat thinking, am I present now? I guess I was present just then, but now I'm not. And let's see, I got from this room to that room. I didn't notice what was going on. I guess I wasn't present. I got moved my hand here, and I noticed the incoming breath and the outgoing breath. I was present. And really strong attention. I've counted 15 breaths in a row, and I was there for the in and the out. That's really being present. I mean, what is being present? It's a measurement. You're setting up. Have you ever not been present? How could you talk about that? I mean, if you weren't present, where were you? Well, you might think I was somewhere else. Where was that? Well, let me think about that. I guess it was in my unconscious. Yeah. That's where I was. I was in my unconscious. I was away on a visit. That's it. And that's, I believe that, yeah, that's where I was. I got to stay conscious so I don't get into the unconscious. Because if I'm staying conscious, then I'm present and I can count my breath. Usually right after each other, and I'm very aware that the breath is going in and out. Otherwise, I'm unconscious.
You're
ruining my career. Oops. Just remember, this is just one way of talking about it. Just one way of talking about it. I mean, you know, we have to say something, right? If we didn't say something, then what? Well, no, I won't ask that question. But there is a way to use language. I mean, I might think, I've thought, God, what a mess language is then. I mean, what are you going to do? You're faced with talking, and if you can't explain anything with language, then what? I mean, you can explain things, but suppose you don't, you know, that just isn't, you know that the way you're explaining it, it's just, you're just kind of setting something up to, you know, like I'm explaining that if I move this here, then that foot's going to get warm. It's an explanation. Maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. But there are other ways to use language that are very beautiful, where sometimes you're not really trying to explain anything. You're just, it's like a bird singing. You know, tweet, tweet, tweet. And for me, poetry is a lot like that. Like I have some haiku I was just reading that have just so described this sense of kind of giving up with language in a way and still using it to do that. No good, thank you. No bad, thank you. No, please. I prefer drinking tea, sometimes asleep, sometimes awake. Even after Satori, willows just as green as before. Given it up, you say? But what have you given up? Very well, you've given up the idea of giving up. Yes or no, good or bad, all arguments are gone. More beautiful tunes come from pine winds on the hill. Or, it's comfortable to live deep in the mountains because grasses and trees never say yes and no. Really nothing to say in words. Asking itself, answering itself, the sounds of pine winds. Or these death poems, or there's some Japanese death poems that I was reading in. This is just like, language is just expression. It could mean anything, I think. Oh, the monks, there's a tradition in Japanese, from Japanese Zen monks, to write a poem at the time of death, just as you're dying. It's part of your spiritual practice, of course. I mean, it's regarded as part of the tradition in Zen. So there's a book of collected poems of monks just as they're dying, what they write. These are some of them. The joy of dewdrops in the grass as they turn back to vapor. Here's another one. Spitting blood clears up reality and dream alike. Here's another one. Some of them are quite to the point. For example, death poems are mere delusions. Death is death. And here's another one. And if I do become a spirit, the party's over. Another one, maybe? Yeah. I lean against the stove and lo, eternity. And there's one more. A parting word, the melting snow is odorless. Kind of just to the point. Right. Well, any further questions?
But you were talking to me about this social agreement about work. And can you say something about how it is that then we all mean slightly different things?
You mean it's something about how we come to agree that words, that we mean the same thing when we speak? That, I'm just wondering if that's what you're talking about.
No.
Well, a lot of the time, I think it just happens in it's cultural. Certain cultures, like in England, there's a different definition of clean than America. Like, because sometimes in England, I found out when I came here that it's actually a regular practice that when you are washing the dishes, you don't necessarily rinse them off. You just put them on the rack. I couldn't believe it. The first time I said that, I said, oh, you mean when you wash the dishes, you don't wash the dishes off. You just kind of leave the soap on. Oh, yeah, everyone is like, what do you do in England? So, and I said, oh, I see there's a different definition of clean here at work. You know, so then it was like agreement. Oh, I see, clean is different here than it is there. So that's like coming to an agreement, you know, about what clean is, just based on what we do. Just, you know, how we're going to use that word. You know, like now after I put the dish over here and it's still got soap on it, I'm calling that clean. And, you know, right. That's another one. Now, and for some people, that's okay, clean, I can live with that kind of clean. Now, my sister maybe would not be able to live with that kind of clean. Or whatever. Because she wants me to rinse the dishes twice. When you're rinsing the dishes, that's the way a bachelor would rinse the dishes. So that's like one agreement. The other agreement is just in talking to each other. And I think this has been going on a lot in the group. Just the way the group sometimes it's just a question of I'm saying something. I'm talking to you about what it means for me to listen to you. And you might be nodding, saying, yeah. And then all of a sudden you say, what? And suddenly there's a sense that what I'm talking about and what you're hearing may not be the same thing. And then it's the question, well, it seemed like something didn't get across to anything. Yeah, you were saying that listening to somebody means paying attention to what they're talking about and digesting what it is that they're saying. And the person says, I actually don't eat what people say. That doesn't make quite a lot of sense. You may be using that word digest in a different way than I usually do that when I'm eating food. You know, that's getting agreement just in talking with each other, you know, it's the agreement often is just as simple as, you know, I'm saying something and you don't understand, or you keep understanding and suddenly you don't understand, and we have to redefine what we mean by this word. So it could be right in that situation.
But then it's a continuous process.
I view it as a very continuous process, ongoing. I mean, certain things we assume, you know, like I couldn't talk to you otherwise if you didn't, you know what some of what I'm talking about is referring to. I mean, what the words would mean. But it's interesting, you know, I was driving along the highway, the expressway here, or what do you call it?
The road.
Yes. Yeah, it's like, you know, in England you have funny words to say. Road.
They're quite old.
Yeah. Never would have thought of that. But it's just seeing the signs, you know, on the highway. And I was just thinking, as soon as I see a sign with a word in English on it, it's like I just see the word right away and I know what it means. It's so quick. It's like I don't see these white colors with these little kind of curves and, you know, they're on this green background, and it's like immediately, turn off here. I was thinking, what would it be like for somebody from China who's driving along the road, as you probably have all experienced, you might have experienced it sometimes, and seeing this weird little thing posted there, you know, who doesn't even have road signs. It might be just the funniest thing. And he said to him, oh, that's a sign over there. That's a sign. I say, oh, yeah, a sign, I see. Very interesting, you know. Just based on defining things and pointing it out and saying that's what it is.
That's
leg.
No, this is, or no matter how I call it, or this is my existence.
Well, I don't know. Well, when you're sitting, and you're sitting and you're deep in samadhi, very concentrated, body is utterly still, no sensations at all. Just the wind. That's all there is. Is that a leg? I mean, that, you know, to me, you know, it's a leg as long as you're saying, and does it exist even? Well, not at that moment. Not at that moment. It's again very, it depends on, you know, what you say at that moment, what you're calling what at that moment. Even to say, you know, but I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, I'm just saying what happened. It depends on what your point of view is, as to what's, you know, what's there and what isn't there. Like if I turn around and look at the wall, did you all disappear? On present evidence, it looks that way. Just on present evidence, not on the memory of or, you know, the thought about or something. That would just be the thought about. Just on looking. I mean, that's the thing that we, you know, just looking at the current, in this current moment. That's the way I would look at it.
One of the problems with the English language when I'm writing teaching is the fact that verbs of emotion and verbs of opinion and verbs of possessive don't take the continuous tense, the inform, which is what we use for now. And so, like, you can't say my leg isn't existing now. It has to be, it doesn't exist. And you can't say I'm loving you now. I love you. It has to be a fact.
Although you did say something very interesting there, which is, I mean, the way you talked about it was more that way. You know, like saying to somebody, I mean, look at the difference between saying to somebody, I love you, and right now I'm loving you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's much more, at this particular time, in this particular, my language, we can reflect it.
But I was just thinking that it's the fact that language has to guide you to say it, you can't say these things.
Right, right. There seems to be some kind of way of the current usage, which is wants the making it more definite in some way, much more. But I think how pleasant it would be if every time you said to yourself something like, I'm happy, or if you said something like, I'm shy, if you change it to, right now, as I'm looking at you, I'm feeling shy. Or, how would you know, putting that ing on it. I'm shying right now. That doesn't mean that I'm always going to be shying. So it's nice to think of moving the language more towards just being, just right now. This is the way I'm talking about it. I think that can be very helpful as a way to use language, rather than feeling stuck in this, like it's always going to be this way.
Yeah,
the ink.
When you do the language and the meditation and the various experiences, do you just take sort of very rough descriptions of what's going on, or you know what?
Well, I actually don't use labeling a lot, because I mean, some people do, and it's a way of practice. But I just found I get too caught up in labeling. I notice that after a while I'm just kind of have a mantra going, pain, thinking, and like I'm saying a lot of different things. So, I prefer just not to, but again, it's a form of practice that some people use as a way to gather attention, develop a certain focus, et cetera, et cetera.
But, anyway. I wonder if you have anything to say about the amount of discrimination that you can use depending upon the language. What I mean, but I have a continuing fantasy of two people discussing, in general, riding horses in the snow. One being English, the other being an Eskimo. The Eskimo has one word for horse and 40 different ones for snow, and we have one word for snow and about 30 different ones for kind of horse. And there's this different discrimination available to them. I wonder if you have any.
Yeah, well, having lots of different words helps in terms of giving different nuances or shades to, you know, it's like if an Eskimo talks about snow, they have 30 different uses for snow too, probably. So they have 30 different words for it, so it gives them a much more, it doesn't make snow just this black or white thing, like it's, there's either snow or there isn't snow. Kind of.
Do you think our perception of snow is actually worsened by not having very many?
It depends. We don't use snow in the ways that Eskimos use it. It would have to be worsened in what, according to what end, to what objective. I mean, if I needed to do 30 different things with snow, I'd probably need to have 30 more words about snow. So. Well, I'm just thinking maybe it might be nice to take a few minutes and be in quiet together and, and then the inquiry, I guess, is going to start. Immediately afterwards, you never really have to talk a whole lot more. And one other thing I'd like to add, which is just to remember that I'm not saying language doesn't make a difference. I think it can make all the difference in the world. What I'm saying is to be aware of what you're saying, the kinds of divisions that you're making with language, and the consequences that can come from making those divisions, and to question, to explore, to see whether things are really the way that you've said they are, and they always will be that way, or if this is just a way of making a particular division with a name, and what the implications of that are for action, for understanding.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.